I would like to ask Sam to come up, and he will do our scripture reading for us.
We shall be taking our scripture reading from Hosea. Hosea chapter 10. From the Pew Bible is on page 960. Hosea 10, 1 to 15. Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields his fruit. The more his fruit increased, the more the altars he built. As his country improved, he improved his pillars. Their heart is false. Now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their pillars. For now they will say, "We have no king, for we do not fear the Lord. And a king, what could he do for us?" They utter mere words. With empty oaths they make covenants. So judgment springs up like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. The inhabitants of Samaria tremble for the calf of Beth-Aven. Its people mourn for it, and so do its idolatrous priests, those who rejoiced over it and over its glory. For it has departed from them. The thing itself shall be carried to Assyria as tribute to the great king. Ephraim shall be put to shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his idol. Samaria's king shall perish like a twig on the face of the waters. The high places of heaven, the scene of Israel, shall be destroyed. Thorn and thistle shall grow up on their altars, and they shall say to the mountains, "Cover us," and to the hills, "Follow us." From the days of Gibeah you have sinned, O Israel. There they have continued. Shall not the war against the unjust overtake them in Gibeah? When I please, I will discipline them. And nations shall be gathered against them when they are bound up for their double iniquity. Ephraim was a trained calf that loved to thresh, and I spared her fair neck. But I will put Ephraim to the yoke. Judah must plow. Jacob must harrow for himself. Sow for yourselves righteousness. Reap steadfast love. Break up your fallow ground. For it is a time to seek the Lord, that he may come and rain righteousness upon you. You have plowed iniquity. You have reaped injustice. You have eaten the fruit of lies. Because you have trusted in your own way and in the multitude of your warriors, therefore the tumult of war shall arise among your people, and all your fortresses shall be destroyed. As Shalman destroyed Beth-Abel on the day of battle, mothers were dashed in pieces with their children. Thus it shall be done to you, O Bethel, because of your great evil. At dawn, the king of Israel shall be utterly cut off. May God bless his reading in our hearts.
Horticulture is the science and the art of planting and growing vegetables, fruits, ornamental plants, and flowers. How many of you here consider yourself someone who dabbles in horticulture? Yeah. How many of you consider yourself somewhat maybe more of an expert or really dedicated to horticulture? Nobody? Nobody. Oh, because I have a question. Question will be on the screen. What happens, or what should we do if we plant strawberries and all we get is leaves but no fruit? Cut back on the what? hydrogen or nitrogen. It's got to cut back on the fertilizer. Yes, actually, that's one of the things. Certain types of fertilizer, if you over-fertilize, you're going to get lots of foliage, lots of leaves, but no fruit. What else could cause such a thing? The plants could be too young. They're not old enough to produce fruit yet. Another thing could be too much water or too dry or too hot, too cold. That's all according to gardeningknowhow.com. Not my experience. But God is somewhat of a horticulturalist himself. He planted a vine. Now, he didn't just plant a vine. He planted a whole vineyard. And I'd like you to turn to the instance of that, not in Hosea, but in Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5, God the horticulturalist. And he had an experience like maybe that you had. You planted and you tended a plant, and you didn't get any fruit. Or you bought and you tended an ornamental plant and didn't get any flowers. Chapter 5 of Isaiah, verse 1. Let me sing for my beloved my song, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. Now the translation wild grapes is probably would have been better if they just translated literally means stink fruit. So here's this vineyard that has been planted and cared for, invested in heavily, and the guy gets this fruit that you can't eat, that you can't use. It's just a stink fruit. Now, what do you do with such vines or a whole vineyard that does not give you the grapes that you want? Well, the next couple verses ask Israel that question in this song. What do you do? What more can you do for a vineyard that only yields stink fruit? You pull it out. You rip it up. You tear it out. There's no point in putting more effort and more time and money into plants that are not going to give you the fruit that you desire. And that's exactly what happens. You take a look at verses 5 and 6. So he continues in his song, and it elaborates on the destruction or the tearing out of that vineyard. But then, verse 7, it comes and explains something very important. It explains that actually the song is a metaphor. The song about a vineyard and his friend stands for God, who is the person who planted the vineyard, and Israel is that vineyard. So it says in verse 7, For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasing planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, an outcry. So the point of the metaphor is very simple. God planted in a land, in the land of Canaan, a people, a nation. And he was looking for certain behavior. He was looking for a certain way of life in return. And he didn't get it. So he's going to uproot them from the land that he planted them in. He's going to take them out of the land because they have only produced evil and rebellion. They refused to walk in the purposes that he established them, or they refuse to walk in the purposes he planted them for. So just like a vineyard that doesn't give you the fruit that you want, that is desirous and good, you rip it out. So having reviewed this more fully described metaphor of Israel as a vineyard, now we're ready to take a look at Hosea chapter 10. And when we come to verse 1, again, it is mentioning that Israel is the vine that has been planted, and God is the one who planted the vine. But the problem is slightly different here. The problem here is not that Israel doesn't have fruit, but it's using the fruit for itself. The ESV here in verse 1 muddles the translation a bit. It says, Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. Some of you have the NIV, the KJ, or the NASB. It actually says, Israel is a vine that brings forth fruit for itself. That's the proper or better translation than the ESV, and lets us clearly know what's going on here. So the vine is producing fruit, but it's using that fruit for itself. The vine dresser, God, isn't getting fruit. Again, we need to remember the dynamics between God and between Israel. God chose Israel by grace, by mercy. He took them out of Egypt, and then he enabled them to become a nation. He organized them. He enabled them to produce food in the land, and he protected them. He enabled them to feed themselves. And if they would obey him and worship him exclusively, as they agreed, he then would bless them in tremendous ways. But over time, how did Israel respond to this blessing, to this being planted in the land? How did they respond to God's grace? Well, sadly, Hosea chapter 2, verses 8 and 9 revealed to us earlier that they knew, no longer knew or recognized that it was Yahweh, the true God, who had planted them, that it was Yahweh who was the one who enabled them to increase in number, who enabled them to have commerce and silver and gold and trade with the other nations. And so, as in chapter 2, verse 8, as in chapter 10, verse 1, it reports that the Israelites attributed their prosperity, their growth, to the Baals, to foreign gods, to the Canaanite gods. And then using that prosperity, that fruit that God had given them, they used that to multiply altars, sacred stones, standing altars and shrines and pillars for a syncretistic and outright idolatrous worship. So they're producing stink fruit, a stinky, unholy worship, and an unethical, ungodly lifestyle. Whatever good that they had, whatever abilities they had, they used it for themselves to worship and bring forth unholy worship. They rejected God and his command to have any other God. And in doing that, they did not produce at all the fruit that God was looking for. They did not fulfill the purposes God had planted them in the land. So, as previously asked, what do you do with a fruit tree that doesn't give you the fruit that you're expecting to? Year after year, if the apple tree or the cherry tree does not give you fruit, what do you do with it? Even if it's at age and getting the right fertilizer, you chop it down. You burn it up in the wood stove. What do you do with the flowers that you planted, but they never bloom? You tear them out and you go get yourself some other flowers that will give you flowers. So this is what Hosea chapter 10, verses 2 through 10 speak about. It describes how God is going to tear out of the land this nation that he planted. That's what this chapter is about. The taking out, the ripping up of the vine or Israel out of the land of Canaan, out of the promised land. Three things are focused on for destruction in this chapter: the many religious shrines that are referred to, and the altars and the pillars and the standing stones, the king, and then also that central national idol that was that calf. The method of destruction: how is God going to cause them to be put out of the land? War. That's what this chapter reveals. They shall be uprooted through war. This is nothing new. God told them way back under Moses, under the list of curses, that if they were to break that command and break the commandments and be disobedient, God would uproot them from the land. The land would vomit them out. And one of the ways that was described in Leviticus 26, verses 30 to 33, was war. It says this, "And I will destroy your high places and cut down your incense altars and cast your dead bodies upon the dead bodies of your idols, and my soul will abhor you. And I will lay waste your cities and make your sanctuaries desolate, and I will not smell your pleasing aromas. And I myself will devastate the land so that your enemies who settle in it shall be appalled at it. And I will scatter you among the nations, and I will unsheath the sword after you. And your land shall be a desolation, and your cities shall be a waste." So this is the first metaphor that we find in this chapter. God is speaking about them as a nation. He says, I created you for some certain purposes. You're not fulfilling it. You're not bringing the fruit of righteousness and things that I expected. Therefore, I'm going to rip you up from the land, and that will be through war. But there's a second image, a second metaphor, a livestock metaphor. So we see that in verses 11 through 15, it's repeating the similar points to the horticultural metaphor of a plant, but this time Israel's a calf, and God's the livestock, or the one who's raising the calf. This metaphor begins at the beginning of Israel's history. This part about a calf that is pleasant and is doing the threshing of the grain. It speaks of a calf that has a pleasant relationship, a cooperative relationship with its owner. But God is going to do more and wants Israel to do more than just kind of have the threshing of grain. He wants to put it to harder tasks. He wants Israel to work with him to break up ground and to plant the seeds of righteousness so that in the end they may reap righteousness. He wants them to plant righteousness in the land that they are in so that that's what they reap. And how would they sow righteousness? That would be, according to Deuteronomy 6, 24 and 25, by obeying the laws and commands of God. So as they obey God's commands, they're sowing righteousness, and that will come back and bring a harvest. Now, it does mention here that it speaks of Judah and this all-encompassing name of Jacob. Well, again, this is speaking of a time before Israel had divided, before they had divided into north and south. So this is why Israel is seen as just one entity. So at that time, what was God's purpose as he put them in the land? Well, they were all to sow this righteousness. And therefore, it uses that encompassing name of Jacob and refers to Judah. But what did they do? Hosea chapter 10, verse 13, reveals that instead you have plowed iniquity, you have reaped injustice, you have eaten the fruit of lies, because you have trusted in your own way and in the multitude of your warriors. So they did not sow righteousness. Instead, as we saw back in chapter 4, verse 16, they were a stubborn cow. They might have been a cooperative calf, but as they grew, they became stubborn. They would not do the work that God had for them. They would not sow righteousness. They decided to do their own things, act more like a wild bull, untamed and dangerous, doing whatever they please. So, rebelliously, they sowed wickedness, injustice, and now they're going to reap destruction. So again, verses 14 and 15 declare what was the same message earlier in the chapter, the judgment of war. War is coming. The calf is going to be slain. It will not live. It will not survive in the land. It will too be destroyed. And there is a reference that is made to Beth Arable, a real battle that they understood, that they knew about in verse 14. And it says, this is what it will be like for this generation of Israelites in the land. So when you plant and cultivate a tree or a flower or an ornamental plant, you're expecting something in return. You're expecting a harvest of fruit. You're expecting a blossoming of flowers. And when you get a calf or you're breeding cows for calves, you're expecting veal in return, or you're expecting milkers in return. You don't exist for the flower. You don't exist for the calf, for the cow. They exist for you. You have chosen them for certain purposes. Likewise with God, as he was choosing or electing the nation of Israel as his. He had purposes for them. He had things for them to do, to achieve, and to be. So this brings us to the issue of the choosing or the election of Israel. It's a key idea behind this chapter, and it comes out explicitly in chapter 11, verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. So let's ask this question briefly for a moment from a different number of angles. Think about Abraham. He was a wandering Aramean. He once worshipped other gods along with his ancestors. But God chose this wandering Aramean called Abram, who we also know later as Abraham. And he says, I'm going to bless you. Why? Why did God choose Abram to bless him? The answer to that in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 2 says, so that he and his descendants would be a blessing to others. God didn't just choose Abraham to bless him, and then Abraham says, okay, this is great, this is good, I'm just getting here. No, God says, I'm blessing you so that you can be a blessing to others. The descendants of Abraham were blessed with population and a land so that, according to Genesis 26, verse 4, the nations would be blessed. So Israel got put in that land and were able to grow there so that they could bless the rest of the nations. Why did God take the Hebrews out of slavery in Egypt? Why did he choose them to make them a nation and give them a land? Exodus 19, verses 5 to 6 says this, now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So God's given Israel the chance, a unique chance that no other nation gets. You will be chosen by me, unlike all the other nations, and you shall be a nation of priests. What are priests? Priests are servants. Priests work. Priests serve the deity. Priests serve the worshipers of the deity. See, God didn't just choose them and give them a land for them to do nothing and just receive. He says, I'm giving you a position that is highly privileged and it has great blessing and you will receive much. But I also then, in this, I'm giving you responsibility. I'm giving you the responsibility to be my people, but you need to learn to live as my people. And you need to be a witness to the rest of the nation. So as you are blessed, bless others. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5 and 8 say, see, I have taught you statutes and rules, as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do them in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who when they hear of all these statutes will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today? So what would make Israel a great nation is not their military, not their commerce and trade, not their wealth, but what would make them great is that they obeyed the laws of God, and then through the nations they would gain a reputation of being wise and discerning. And that would be the testimony to the nations. That would be a witness to the nations. So as they obeyed God's laws, sowed righteousness through that obedience, they would reap discernment and greatness of knowing God, which in turn was a witness to the rest of the nations. And they could say, hey, we want to know this God too, because we see how great and how awesome he is through your obedience and through how he's organized you as a nation and how he has blessed you. We'd like to know more about him. Roger Hedlund writes in his book, The Mission of the Church in the World, it is sometimes suggested that God showed partiality in his choice of Israel to the exclusion of others. Election does not imply favoritism. Election is not for private enjoyment, but to service. God's election of Israel does not thereby exclude anyone. The privilege of knowing God and being known by him is but the privilege of glorifying him among the nations. Election is not primarily privilege, but responsibility. Her election set Israel apart from the nations so that she might, in a particular way, serve God and reveal his glory and lordship upon the earth. End of quotation. But what did we learn about Israel? So she has been chosen. She had been planted in this land for these purposes. But what did they do? Well, you go back to chapter 4, verse 1 of Hosea, and God's indictment, his charge against Israel was what? That there is no love, there is no faithfulness, and there's no knowledge of God in the land. They had utterly failed to produce the fruit that God was looking for. The people themselves didn't even know God. How could they be a witness? In fact, they were reaping deception. Nobody could know who God was by looking at the Israelites because they were there among the nations worshiping all the Baals. They were no different than the Canaanites. And so God, looking at this stink fruit, says, well, it's time to rip them up out of the land because nobody's going to learn about me this way if they keep living and acting like this and they have thoroughly broken my covenant. It's time to kill the stubborn cow because it won't do what I raised it for. The election of the church. That was chapter 10 of Hosea and what it's about. But this topic of election brings us to the election of the church. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. The Jews were once God's people, but they lost that position. They broke the covenant, as we see so clearly through Hosea and the other prophets. So they became, as God said, not my people. They will not receive mercy. And then the rest of us who have no Jewish heritage, we never had that opportunity. We never had that covenant in the first place. But in Jesus Christ, the beautiful thing is, in the new covenant that God has made, whether you come from a Jewish background or a non-Jewish background, we all can become the people of God again. Those of us who were not loved can become loved. Those of us who did not receive mercy can receive mercy. Those of us who are not his people can become his people again. If you come to faith in Christ, we are called to be his chosen special people. And this, again, we must remember as the people of God is not for just our own pleasure, our own benefit. He calls us, He called us out of darkness into his light and gave us responsibility. He elected us to be his people, to be priests, to work, to fulfill purposes, to fulfill the privilege of serving. And there's a number of ways I've put that on the screen. What have we, as God's people, as God's church, as God's family, as God's priesthood, what are we elected to do? We are elected to serve and worship. John 4:23. The hour is here, Jesus said, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. Part of the whole deal with Old Testament Israel was that they were to worship God exclusively, but they refused to. It's no different for God's people now. We are called. We have been chosen to be his worshipers, exclusive worshipers of him only. We are called to serve in evangelism, to spread the gospel, the news that we all may call upon the name of the Lord and be saved, that we all can become part of the family of God through faith in Jesus Christ. But how can they call upon the Lord if they have not heard? So Paul speaks about sending others out. Matthew 24:14 says the gospel has to be preached in the whole world before the end of the world will come. So what are we doing? This is our election. This is what we have been chosen for. This is what we are made to do as the church. Go into the whole world and proclaim this gospel. Proclaim the name of Jesus so that people may call out to him and be saved. We're to make disciples. We don't just make or seek to have converts to the Christian faith. We need to bring them up. We're not interested in just making babies in terms of the Christian faith, newborn Christians. We want to make adult, mature Christians. So for Matthew 28, it says, go make disciples and teach them everything that I've commanded. Teach them to obey it. And then you have Ephesians chapter 4, where it speaks of the church was given various offices of apostle, prophet, pastor, teacher, evangelist. And what were they given to the church for? To train up the church, to train up you, so that you may go do the work of the ministry in the world and among each other. That's what you're elected to do. So that in the end, all of us working together, the church becomes mature. Grows up under the one head, Jesus Christ. And then we are to serve in doing righteousness. We've mentioned this a few weeks ago. Romans chapter 6, 13 and 19, about how we are to offer our bodies, offer our minds, offer the parts of our bodies to do righteousness. This is what God has called us to do. He calls us to live our life and offer it to do what is right. That's how we sow righteousness. We hear his word and we obey it. And Ephesians chapter 2:10 says that God had prepared works for us to do even before we believed in him. That's what he chose us for. Are we doing those works? So true worship, proclaiming the gospel, disciple-making, doing righteous things. Are you bearing fruit in these things? Is this the fruit that we can see in our lives as a church and as individuals? John 15:8 says this, by this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples.